very serious attempt. They have the House investigation into January 6th never probed the military in any serious way. But Trump certainly knows who was on his side and who was not. And that's one issue that he wants to take up fairly quickly, because the policies that he proposes to carry out, beginning with the war against immigrants, which he's defined as a war, he calls them an invasion, it will involve the use of the military. And therefore, it has to have military officers commanding it who are loyal to the policies and persona of Trump. And so I think it's quite serious.
Patrick, Trump's announced the establishment of what he calls the Department of Governmental Efficiency, and they're supposed to be cutting the budget. I'm afraid that what they're going to do is cut everything except the military budget. Is that your opinion?
Yes. It's notable, for instance, that Elon Musk has intervened now into the budget crisis under conditions, but he waited, and Trump waited, until after the National Defense Authorization Act was passed by Congress and signed into law by Biden. So whatever happens in terms of the budget, they don't yet have the military appropriations bill, but they have the authorization bill, which is more important. That's been passed. That sets policy. They are going to cut spending. They won't cut spending in certain other areas as well. And let me give you the most important one. They will not cut the payment of interest on the national debt, which is now larger than the Pentagon budget. The United States will spend nearly $1 trillion on the military next year, or this year, the fiscal year that began in October, and it will spend more than $1 trillion on interest payments. And now you can guess who gets the lion's share of the interest payments, and they would not be very friendly if Trump was to cut that off. So interest payments will be made, the military will be paid for. What does that leave in terms of the budget? Well, the total U.S. budget is about $6 trillion. If you take out $1 trillion for the military and $1 trillion for interest payments, that leaves you with $4 trillion. Now, the goal of Ramaswamy and Elon Musk is to cut $2 trillion in supposed waste and wasteful government spending. That means 50% of all government spending that isn't the military and interest. Now, you cannot do that without cutting the biggest remaining spending programs, which are Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. You can talk all you want about abolishing the Department of Education. That's a drop in the bucket. It's, I think, $80 billion. If you're going to cut $2 trillion, you have to cut substantially from the payments to the elderly. That's the only way to do it. And however they try to dress it up, that's where they're headed.
Well, you've characterized in general, Patrick, Trump's nominees as authoritarian and, or in some cases, fascist. I wanted to ask you about several of them. How, for example, do you evaluate Pete Hegseth, the head of the Department of Defense, or the person he's suggested for the Environmental Protection Agency and the people he wants to see on the National Labor Relations Board? What do you think about them, and what is their mission, if you will, if Trump does succeed in getting these people on board?
Well, I think there may be some differences amongst them. Hegseth is clearly a fascistic figure. He has long-standing ties to the ultra-right. He has extremely backward views on gender, on gays. He wants to, I think he's sufficiently characterized in my previous answer about the generals. He is one of those who wants to, as they put it, de-woke the Department of Defense. But what they really mean is subordinate the military entirely to the personal directives of Trump. Former Congressman Lee Zeldin has been nominated for the Environmental Protection Agency. I think he's a conventional conservative Republican, ran for governor. His purpose is to simply render the agency completely inoperative. They haven't said that they want to shut down the EPA, but that's the purpose. They want to eviscerate any agency that in any way impedes or regulates or restrains the extraction of corporate profit. Same thing with the guy who's the head of the Department of Energy. One thing which is characteristic of the cabinet, which is unusual by American standards, is its wealth. And I'm not just talking about Elon Musk, because that's another order of magnitude, but there are 8 or 9 billionaires besides him and Trump who are taking top positions in the Trump administration. So we have been characterizing this as a government of, by, and for the oligarchy. And I think that's literally the case.
Patrick, unfortunately, we've come to an end to our allotted time, and we're going to have to let you go. But before we do, do you have any further thoughts? And how can people follow your work?
Well, I'll answer the second question first so I don't run out of time. I write for the World Socialist website, which is www.org. It is the most widely read socialist website on the internet. That's my location. Okay, my final thought is that difficult as the current situation appears, one has to remember that the most powerful social force on the planet is the international working class, that workers produce everything, that the people that we're talking about are all parasites who play no essential function in global economy except to extract personal profit from it. And historically, their class rule has become a complete impediment to the development of society, to the safety of the planet, as we see in the climate crisis, to the health of the population, as we see in the series of pandemics that have come one and now there's another. And of course, the overriding threat, and that is the threat of nuclear war. So the question is to make this vast majority of the world's population conscious both of the dangers that they face and of the enormous power which they can exercise if they do so collectively. And that's what we're seeking to do through the World Socialist website.
Excellent.
You take it easy. We're looking forward to having you back. We'll see how things develop.
Yes, thank you so much.
Glad to talk to you guys.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
Last month, in a landmark verdict, a jury in a federal court in Virginia found a government contractor liable for its role in the torture of 3 Iraqi men at the infamous Abu Ghraib prison back in 2003-2004, and it ordered the company to pay a total of $42 million in compensatory and punitive damages to the men who brought the lawsuit. The plaintiffs were represented by attorneys from the famed Center for Constitutional Rights in New York City, as well as pro bono counsel from Patterson, Belknap, Webb and Tyler, and Akeel and Valentine. The private defendant company, acting as a government contractor, was CACI Premier Technology, Inc. The company was found liable for conspiring to torture and commit cruel, inhumane, and degrading treatment of the Iraqi men, one a middle school principal, one a fruit vendor, and one a journalist. An attorney who filed this landmark case more than 16 years ago is our guest today. She is Catherine Gallagher, senior staff attorney at the Center for Constitutional Rights. Catherine Gallagher, a very warm welcome and congratulations. A warm welcome to Law and Disorder Radio.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me back.
Catherine, let's get a bit of background on the case. And my understanding was it was the first case of its kind to make it to trial. And yet, of course, the whole world, rather early on, it's been some time, learned of the tortures taking place at Abu Ghraib prison, and did it not? In the press release on this victory, the Center for Constitutional Rights, where you work, states, and I quote, "It also brings a new degree of accountability to the shadowy realm of security contractors at a time when employees of private companies, integral to the U.S. war on terror, have often been implicated in human rights abuses across the globe," end of quote. So talk to us about that, but talk to us first as well about the three prevailing plaintiffs and then the importance of this case.
Thank you. The three plaintiffs in this case are truly the heroes of this case for trusting a set of U.S. lawyers for the possibility of justice, for turning to a U.S. court, and for believing that a U.S. judge and a U.S. jury would, I think they thought a lot sooner, but would one day return a measure of justice to them for what happened at Abu Ghraib. So the three men are Suhail, Assad, and Salah al-Ijali. The three of them were picked up in the roundups that were happening across Iraq back in the fall of 2003, and all were detained at the Abu Ghraib prison, which for many of us of a certain generation is equal to torture. It's synonymous with torture. That's where those horrific photos came out in the spring of 2004. So Salah was working as a journalist with Al Jazeera at the time that he was arrested. He was covering an IED explosion and was picked up and sent to Abu Ghraib. Assad was a driver who was picked up and also taken to Abu Ghraib. And Suhail is a longtime educator who was held in Abu Ghraib in U.S. detention for years. While at Abu Ghraib, all three men were subjected to the same kinds of acts of physical and mental torture. They were kept naked for extended periods of time. They were beaten. They were held in contorted positions intended to inflict maximum pain and exhaustion on them. They were subjected to continual mental threats of harm to themselves and to others. And because they were in Abu Ghraib, that infamous two-tier hard site where the photos were taken, they could hear the torture of other detainees, which itself was a form of mental torture. And so over the course of the time that they were there at Abu Ghraib, they were intended to be broken, to be softened up for interrogation. So this torture wasn't gratuitous. It wasn't without a purpose. It was actually intended to break them and all the other Iraqi men, women, and boys who were subjected to such acts, to break them so that they would give so-called actionable intelligence during interrogations. But none of these men knew anything or had done anything wrong. They were all released without charge, which is not to say that anyone should be subjected to torture. But after release, they sought some measure of justice for what they had endured, and that's when they brought this case against CACI, C-A-C-I, the private contractor that was hired to support U.S. interrogation services at Abu Ghraib.
Well, Catherine, correct me if I'm wrong, but my understanding is it was quite a challenge to get this case to court and to trial, wasn't it? The company managed well to keep it from fruition for, what, 16 years at least. Briefly tell us about the difficulties you had to overcome to finally get their plaintiffs their day in court. And by the way, wasn't the brilliant former head of the Center for Constitutional Rights, Michael Ratner, now sadly deceased, originally involved in this case as well?
Yes, let me start with Michael, who is really instrumental to so much of my work at CCR and indeed to this case. As Abu Ghraib, the precursor, of course, was the U.S. invasion of Iraq, and Michael and CCR were very active in trying to forestall that unlawful invasion. And that was a war that was largely about profit, whether through oil or otherwise. And so when the indications came out that there were private military contractors who were implicated in the torture at Abu Ghraib, and that came out through U.S. military reports, investigations done such as by General Taguba and General George Fay, they implicated contractors in the conspiracy to torture and otherwise seriously abuse detainees. So Michael, who had long brought human rights cases under the Alien Tort Statute, along with Peter Weiss and Rhonda Copeland, Michael saw that there was a need to also hold the corporation that profited from torture accountable. So this case, Al-Shamari v. Khaki, where we just had the verdict, the successful verdict, was actually the third case in a series of cases that we brought, and Michael was involved in the first of these cases. So his spirit and his brilliance, I think, really helped shape our case. But why it took 16 years is that Khaki, the private contractor, really put forward every defense that it could. And while certainly a defendant should be able to pursue viable legal defenses, it really took this to a extreme level, raising again and again and again the same basic theory. And that is that because they were hired by the U.S. government, everything they did really should point back to the United States and the U.S. military, that they were just following orders, if torture could somehow be a lawful order, or that they were fully integrated in with the military, and therefore it should be the military and not Khaki that should be held liable. But the very terms of Khaki's contract with the U.S. military put it as Khaki's responsibility to recruit and to hire and to supervise trained and experienced interrogators at Abu Ghraib. Khaki was paid tens of millions of dollars to hire quote-unquote resident experts, private contractors, yes, but people who were experienced in interrogations. And instead, what was seen is that they had unqualified individuals stepping into the space of Abu Ghraib, a detention center in U.S., a U.S.-run detention center in U.S.-occupied Iraq, and that these unqualified but very influential interrogators stepped into what was a command vacuum and really helped put in place and set the stage for the torture that happened. They gave instructions and encouraged the kind of abuse that Suhail, Saleh, and Assad were subjected to. So that is why Khaki should be and ultimately was held responsible. But they put forward this range of defenses, including the government contractor defense, the political question doctrine, derivative sovereign immunity, many different labels on the same basic theory that because this torture and cruel and inhuman degrading treatment, these clear violations of international and U.S. law happened in a time of occupation while they were working with the U.S. military, that they shouldn't be held accountable. And the law found repeatedly, again and again and again, that indeed they should be held accountable. And that's how we made it to trial. And then based on the facts, the jury ultimately found them guilty, responsible.
Katie, I remember, you know, Law and Disorder is now 20 years old. Michael Ratner was one of the founders of Law and Disorder. And I remember some of our earliest programs going all the way back around this very topic. So I'm so glad you were able to speak about Michael. But let me ask you this. Jim mentioned in his introduction that ultimately the jury in Virginia awarded the three plaintiffs in this case a total of $42 million in damages, compensatory damages, punitive damages. What specific evidence introduced at the trial having to do with your three plaintiffs do you think caused such a large verdict to be awarded?
Yes. So each plaintiff in this case received a verdict of $3 million in compensatory damages and $11 million in punitive damages. And I think what drove that verdict was really a level of disgust and horror by the jury of what they saw and what they heard, both in terms of what our clients were subjected to and also the denial and the deflection throughout the entire trial by CACI of any level of responsibility for sending over unqualified people and then failing to supervise them. The kinds of harm that our plaintiffs suffered, each of them suffers not only from physical injuries at that time and some lingering effects, certainly, of those physical injuries, but even more the mental harm. And I think it's really important for listeners to understand that torture isn't just physical acts. It's also subjecting people to severe mental harm. And we are talking 20 years after the fact. And I can tell you, to a plaintiff, testimony on the one hand was very empowering, and on the other, it was really, really difficult and destabilizing in some to some extent, because what it asked our Suhail and Saleh and Asad to do was to go back in time to that moment, those days, those months, where they were subjected to some of the worst treatment of their lives, where they worried every moment about their safety and the safety of their family due to threats that were made. That dehumanization, that stripping of any sense of control over themselves, I think it's extremely important for listeners to understand that torture isn't just physical acts, but it's also severe mental harm. And the kind of treatment that Suhail, Asad, and Saleh were subjected to has left a lasting impact on their mental health. And they still suffer feelings of fear, nightmares, the lack of control and agency that they had over their bodies and their safety during those months when they were subjected to torture at Abu Ghraib has never left them. So on the one hand, it was incredibly empowering to finally be able to tell their testimony, their stories, their truth to a U.S. jury. But on the other hand, it was really very difficult. So I think that that is part of what the jury was responding to when they gave $3 million in compensatory damages for each of our plaintiffs, which is what we had asked them to give. And in terms of punitive damages, what we indicated was the cost of the contract to CACI, and that is, again, the number that the jury gave. I think they were trying to send a very clear message to companies, and especially including CACI, that this kind of conduct cannot and will not be tolerated, that it's unlawful.
This is Jim Lafferty along with my co-host Michael Smith on this edition of Law and Disorder. We're talking with Catherine Gallagher, an attorney with the Center for Constitutional Rights, who was instrumental in a successful lawsuit against a private and working as a government contractor with respect to torture at Abu Ghraib. Catherine, in the press release announcing the verdict in this case, you're quoted as saying, and I quote, "With today's verdict, private military and security contractors are put on notice that they can be and will be held accountable when they breach the most fundamental international law protections, like the prohibition against torture, and fail to comply with their contractual and regulatory obligations to ensure their employees follow the law," close quote. So to be clear, I'm wondering, do you contend then that there are other companies or individuals still engaged in similar violations of human rights and justice? They're still operating on behalf of the U.S. government?
I think it's a slightly difficult question to ask when framed that way, but overall, where we're at is that there is so much privatization happening right now with functions that used to be carried out by the United States government. And I think that this is something we're going to see even more of with the incoming administration. So whether it's schools, whether it's private prisons, whether it's detention centers at home for migrants and immigrants, or whether it is overseas in places that we don't know, black sites that we don't know about, there are a lot of private companies that are working alongside of, and in some cases even setting the agenda for the United States government. And at this point, what our case sends is a very clear message to those contractors that just because you work with the United States, profiting from doing work that should be in the public service, in the public interest, that you don't have immunity and certainly don't enjoy impunity if you commit intentional violations of international law, such as torture. These are not mere negligence claims. These are serious violations of law, again, both domestic and international law. Torture is prohibited, clearly prohibited and never justified, and there are no exceptions. So if contractors running a detention center for migrants contribute to acts of torture, then they should be and can be held liable. That's what this case showed. So I do think that there is a message that should be heard and heeded, particularly, again, going into an administration where we might be seeing even more outsourcing of what many of us consider government functions.
Katie, Donald Trump's about to be president again within a month. He's on record as being supportive of keeping prisons such as the U.S. military prison at Guantanamo Bay open and filled. He's also said that he supports torture. Is this a concern of the CCR?
Certainly it is, Michael. Certainly it is. And thank you for mentioning Guantanamo. I think for many, it's a forgotten place, and there are still over 30 individuals held there now for decades without charge in many cases, and individuals who've been cleared to be released who have still been held despite being okayed to go rejoin their families or restart their lives elsewhere. So at this moment, frankly, what's most urgent is for the Biden administration in its final month to close Guantanamo, a promise that was made by Barack Obama and a promise that was made again by Joe Biden. So the first step is to close Guantanamo and make sure that that place, that legal black hole, is no longer operational when Donald Trump comes in. That's the first step. But indeed, yes, we will be watching and ready to act when we see serious human rights violations, which could include torture, but I think we're going to see an array of human rights violations in this next administration, as so many groups are targeted at home, whether it's the LGBTQI community, whether it's Palestinian Solidarity activists, whether it's those who are championing equal rights to, regardless of gender, regardless of religion, regardless of racialized identity. So I think we're going to have a lot of work coming, not only for us at CCR, but I think for all of us who believe in equality and dignity for everyone.
Catherine Gallagher, any final thoughts you might want to share with us, please do. And also, before we end, please let our listeners learn more about the work of the Center for Constitutional Rights. That is to say, how can they learn more? Is there a website they could certainly go to? Talk to us about that, as well as any final thoughts you may have.
Well, first on the case, on El Shamari v. Kaki, while we had a very gratifying victory in November on behalf of our clients, the case is unfortunately not over yet. Kaki has made clear that they will appeal this case up to the Supreme Court if necessary. So already we have been active in post-trial litigation, and we have a hearing coming up on January 10th. On Kaki's motion for a new trial and to have the jury's verdict overturned. So we have that, and then we anticipate, if we're successful there, that there will be an appeal to the Fourth Circuit. So at this point, the work continues, but we certainly had a very, very long in coming and very well-deserved victory for our plaintiffs, and a recognition and a validation of all that they endured and of their trust, really, in a U.S. system to provide some justice. So we are gratified for what we've achieved, and we know that the fight goes on. And you can follow this case or any other work of CCR's at www.ccrjustice.org. We have weekly newsletters that we put out, and you can find information on all of our cases on the website.
We certainly appreciate you being with us today to talk about this incredibly important case. We thank you so much for joining us here on Law and Disorder.
Thanks so much for having me again, and thank you for your continued support of the work of the center and of the plaintiffs and movements that we really have the privilege to represent.
Well, thank you. I just remember Michael Ratner saying, we don't take a case because we think we can win. We take it to expose this government and mobilize people and educate people. But you took this case and you won. Congratulations, and thanks so much for being on Law and Disorder.
Thanks, Michael.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org. One word, lawanddisorder.org.
And I thank our listeners for joining us here today on Law and Disorder, and I urge you all to visit our website, lawanddisorder.org. There you'll learn ways to support the show and spread the message of the show, and we'll appreciate that as well.
Something strong. And infectious.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the first ever episode of City Pop Central here on WRCT Pittsburgh 80.3 FM. As you might have noticed, the name of this time slot have changed a little bit, but the quality of music will definitely stay the same. Here is Kaori Tokage by Tomita Lab.
No. suits of a rinse of flowers. Oh, oh, oh. So let's begin to sing. Sweetness from an early rain shower. Oh, oh. Does this morning at sunrise is to feet on the mountain hands. His feelings of golden glow. Crystal water.
That was Countryside Beauty by a Hawaiian band named Tender Leaf. And before that, we had another Hawaiian band named Summer. And the song was called Kona Day from the 1976 LP, Summer. Before that, we had Mother Goose with Boy Kifuni Sala Salete. And next, we're going to have something that's a little bit more recent. All the way back from the year 2010. Yep, 2010. State Cows with Lost in the Mind Game.
Love. I may not sing a stylish song, yeah, and I may not look the part, but I've got some news that's gonna chase away your blues. Love is here to stay. Stay, yeah. You may have come from a place I'd never been. You may live high upon a hill, but the same thing is true for
we'll be right back. birthday.